Welcome to Parents' Perspective. We interrupt this program for some breaking news, began the voice on the radio. Samantha felt her throat tighten. Her hands gripped the steering wheel harder. An outbreak of a serious, apparently waterborne illness seems to be underway at several county schools. The affected children have been taken to all three county hospitals where they are undergoing tests. Samantha dialed her husband on the cell phone and waited for the connection. So far, continued the announcer, no deaths have been reported. Hey, what's up? Came her husband's voice on the line. Haven't you heard? Samantha could feel her eyes fill up and strain to focus on the road ahead. There's some kind of germ in the water, and kids are getting sick in the schools. I'm going to pick up Celia. Can you go get Carl? Don't you think you should call the kids' school first? Her husband ventured. Call? Samantha could barely keep her composure. Kids are really sick. Some could die. I've just got to get our kids out of there. From a parent's perspective, what should we know in a community or nationwide medical emergency? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has been working in healthcare and healthcare policy for many years. Dr. Lisa G. Kaplowitz is the health director of the Alexandria Health Department. For 6 years, she was deputy commissioner for emergency preparedness and response at the Virginia Department of Health, responsible for development and implementation of Virginia's public health and healthcare response to all natural and man-made emergencies. Dr. Kaplowitz is the mother of two grown sons and grandmother of a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Kaplowitz.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
What would qualify these days as a national medical emergency or a regional or community-wide health emergency?
We consider a medical emergency as an event that stresses the healthcare system. A national emergency would be something that stresses the healthcare system nationally, such as a big outbreak of an infectious disease. We're more likely to have regional or local emergencies, which may be due to weather events. For example, storms, tornadoes. These can cause medical emergencies either because of large numbers of injuries or even damage to healthcare facilities themselves. So there's a broad scope of what would be considered a healthcare emergency or a medical emergency. We certainly worry about anything that stresses the healthcare system, and that is anything that pushes the system beyond the resources, whether it's supplies, equipment, or people.
Are there different dangers medical experts look for today than what they watched for a few years ago?
Well, we're certainly more sensitive to infectious diseases. We've seen a number of new infectious diseases over the past 20, 30 years. It's hard to believe that before 1980, we didn't know about AIDS and HIV. Then we have issues with antibiotic resistance. We have infections that have been very treatable in the past that are less treatable now, largely because of our overuse of antibiotics. So we have infections such as staphylococcal infections that now are resistant to certain antibiotics. It's not an emergency by itself, but it's a new infection that we have to deal with. We have tuberculosis that can be resistant to drugs. We even have malaria that's resistant to the medication that we have. This is a real concern. And then we have concerns about widespread outbreaks of infectious disease because of rapid travel. You know, we've been concerned that avian influenza may spread and may turn into a form that's easily spread from person to person. We don't have that now, but a lot of the planning over the past 3, 4, 5 years has been looking at how to handle a pandemic, a widespread epidemic of influenza or another infectious disease. Climate change, quite frankly, is going to lead to spread of infectious diseases into new areas. So we have to think about that. Will mosquitoes and other vectors spread to other areas of the world? This is something that hasn't been talked about a great deal, but could be a real concern. Then people are sensitized to terrorism. Obviously, since 9/11, We had planes crashing into buildings, concern about explosions, also concerns about bioterrorism that really were raised with anthrax in 2001. Now, this was domestic terrorism, but we've been preparing for the possibility of intentional spread of infections through terrorism. We have to worry about chemical releases. You know, we now have chemicals transported through heavily populated areas, and we know that's a risk, whether by train or truck. You know, we've had chlorine released in South Carolina, and we had to deal with that. And that's something we have to prepare for as well.
As members of the general public, and especially as parents, how would we know if there were a widespread medical emergency?
We have media that will get the word out very quickly. The challenge here is, are people getting the correct information? We work closely with the media to assure that we're getting the key messages across in such a way that we're not causing panic, but we're really giving people instructions of how they should respond. We've worked a great deal on risk communication.
What does that mean?
That means relaying the correct information in the correct way so that people will react appropriately. We know that when people are under stress, they're not going to be hearing everything that's said. Mm-hmm. You need to keep your messages focused, relatively brief, and get your key points across, usually in threes. There's been a lot of research on this, how many words people will actually hear when they're under stress. Three messages, nine words each, and public health has been taking this very seriously to make sure that we are really effectively getting our messages across.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on what kids need in a national or regional medical emergency.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Lisa Kaplowitz about what kids need in a national or regional medical emergency.
Are there specific sources of vital information that we should trust in a crisis?
For medical or public health emergencies, you really can trust your public health sources. And certainly nationally, that's the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC website is really excellent. And if you go to their website, I believe it's cdc.gov, you will see a lot of options. It's laid out pretty well. They actually have the CDC top 10 issues, starting with salmonella, for example. And the CDC website is linked to the Food and Drug Administration website, which gives real details on all the foods to be concerned about. Where localities are linked most closely is to local government and local emergency management. So, for example, in my city of Alexandria, the local emergency manager works closely with government officials to get the right message out for the locality. And then you have emergency management for the state. And then at the federal level, you have FEMA, which I know has gotten some bad press.
That's Federal Emergency Management.
Agency. However, FEMA has some very good points, too, including some of their websites that I can talk about. They have some excellent information for children and preparing children for emergencies, as do a lot of state websites. So we turn to emergency management, which then is responsible for coordinating the emergency response. In a significant emergency, you have an emergency operations center at either a local or state level that coordinates emergency response. And linked to that emergency operations center should be a joint information center that is responsible for making sure there's a coordinated message coming out as well in terms of how people respond. So the media should be linked to the Joint Information Center, which should be linked back to the media. If it's being run right, they'll have their media links already established. The other thing that's changed over the past 7 years is much more engagement of public health in emergency planning and response, as well as closer linkages between public health and the healthcare provider community, hospitals and providers. And this has been a big step. We didn't have that kind of close linkage back before 2002, for example, 2001, 2002.
What's the most important thing for parents to keep in mind in a large-scale medical emergency?
Realize that information is going to change over time. Situations are going to change over time. So it's important to stay informed and, again, to work through really respected and responsible sources of information. Again, I mentioned the CDC and the FDA. For chemical releases or poisonings, everybody has access to a poison control center. This is an excellent resource for all parents to know about, whether it's, you know, exposure in the home or exposure outside the home. There's really a national number that will hook you to your local poison control center, which is an excellent resource for any type of exposure to chemicals. Something that a colleague of mine pointed out as well is that you have more and more use of 211 services. 211 functions at a local level, but really links people to a range of services, many of which are social services. During the California wildfires, 211 service provided information on evacuation routes, on who should evacuate, at what point. Apparently, this worked very well. And these 211 services are really being expanded nationally. It's an alternative to 911. Many people will call 911 for a range of things that aren't true emergencies, and we really want people to use 911 for true emergencies. 211 services is something that people can look into in their communities. It's important to have medical records available, to have these at home that you can carry with you, to know what medications people are taking, what dosages, what allergies, immunizations. It's really important to have a record of your child's immunizations.
Is this the kind of thing parents should just have on a laminated card in their wallet? How do we have – I picture this folder with all this junk.
Well, it's very useful to have it on a card. I also think it's important to have that folder at home with important information. I have one at home where I keep copies of important information that can be grabbed in times of emergency, where I know the information is, but also can be taken with you, including copies of important documents. I think that is very important, and it's one place you could keep medical records or immunization records. At the same time, there are a number of cards that people can use to carry their list of medications, their dosages, their allergies. Immunizations have gotten rather complicated for children. Mm-hmm. The schedule is more and more complicated with a long list of immunizations. It's still important for parents to have a record of these for their children in terms of dates and which immunizations, and a medical problem list if there are significant medical problems. If your child has any special needs, you need to plan for this in emergencies. If you know there's certain supplies they need, put it in your supply kit. And that brings me to the next issue of having an emergency plan that includes having supplies at home in case you lose power, lose water. You want to have some water, some food. And if you need to evacuate your home, to have supplies in one place that you can put into the car.
Now, based on what's in my basement, how often should we refresh that supply of supplies?
Well, they say to refresh your water at least every 6 months, to rotate your cans of food. It takes some effort, but it's a whole lot easier if you have them all in one box. If you have your flashlights, your radios, change of clothes. It sounds complicated, but if you go through the effort, and there are lots of places you can find your lists of supplies to have, including FEMA websites and state emergency websites or public health websites.
Sounds like an awful big box if we're going to have clothes and food and for more than one person.
It depends on the size of your family and your needs. If you have infants, you're going to need diapers. And if you have not only children, but other family members with special medical needs, you'll have to be prepared for that. You're still a whole lot better off preparing this ahead of time and having your plan in place. And your family should know what your plan is. If you need to leave the house, where do you go? Where's a meeting place near the house if there's a fire? Where's a meeting place away from the house if you need to get away from the house? What phone numbers should you have? You should always have an out-of-state contact because sometimes you can't use local phone lines or your cell system's overwhelmed. People count on their cell phones all the time, but in an emergency, there's likely to be problems with people swamping the cell system. It happened during 9/11. It's happened during other emergencies. So often it's easier to reach somebody in another state. So have somebody identified where everybody can call that contact. And that's a way of touching base. You call and say, have you heard from so-and-so, especially with the family doing different things during the day. Know what your school's emergency plan is. Every school has one. And it's important for parents to be aware of this. In a storm, it's best for children to shelter in place. For the scenario you mentioned, it's not a good idea for parents to go picking up their children when there's a tornado watch in place. If they're really serious storms, you want your children to be in a safe area in a building, not on the road. If there's certain chemical releases, it's often better for people to shelter in place, either in their home or in a school. All schools are required to have emergency plans. It's a tendency of parents to want to pick up their children immediately. We see this happen all the time. It's not always the best thing to do, to have your children in the road, on the road, or to have a massive traffic jam when the children may be safe at school, and the best thing is for them to stay put.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on what kids need in a national or regional medical emergency.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Lisa Kaplowitz about what kids need in a regional or national medical emergency.
Sometimes it's very comforting, I think, for kids to be with their friends and in a familiar environment as long as the administrators are calm.
Exactly.
And they know what they're doing. Sometimes it's better than having a frantic parent whisk the child away from all the supports and not know what to do anyway.
Exactly. If your school administrators and teachers are comfortable with their plan and calm, that's a whole lot better than having children on the road and not doing the best thing for the safety of children. People don't always think about pets, and it's important to have a plan for your pets. Are you going to take your pet with you? Will you have some extra pet food at home? People are very attached to their pets, and they have to include that in their emergency plans. And of course, you want to have flashlights. You want to have battery-operated radios. There's some wonderful crank radios that will work really well for a prolonged period of time, and many of them have cell phone chargers in them. So if you lose your power and you can't charge your cell phone, it's nice to have a place to plug them in. And I have a wind-up flashlight. I've given emergency kits to everybody in my family. So they know I take this very seriously.
Dr. Kaplowitz, in a national or regional medical emergency, where is the best place to take a child for medical attention?
You don't necessarily want to rush your child to an emergency room. A lot will depend on whether your child is actually at direct risk. If you're dealing with an infectious disease, you may not want them in an emergency room with lots of other people. So once again, you need to listen for the appropriate information. Many people turn to their healthcare provider for information, which is fine. Public health has taken this on as well. To get information to the public, the best place to go for care, whether to go for care or not, if there's a chemical release, who should go for care, what to do about decontamination, things like that. Local emergency managers and local public officials, again, will be wanting to get the best word out. You also don't want to overwhelm your healthcare system. The emergency room may be caring for people with major trauma, and there may be other sites set up, actually, to care for people with more minor injuries. If there's a widespread infectious disease, there may be sites people should go to for antibiotics or vaccines, something public health's very involved in. So this will be information that will be given out to people through the media. It's very important for children to be up to date on their vaccines. We have heard a lot about problems with vaccines, but vaccines have been amazing at decreasing infectious diseases and provide a great deal of protection for children, whether it's day-to-day or in emergencies. In addition to the usual childhood vaccines, annual influenza vaccine is important for all children and for all people living or working around children, which becomes almost everybody.
Mm-hmm. How are children affected differently than adults in medical emergencies?
First of all, their response can be age-dependent, whether it's to chemicals, infections, or stress. And we can't ignore the stress response. We have to address this in both children and adults. And children may react differently from adults, and we have to think about that very carefully. We need to explain situations to children at an age-dependent level. Children will understand what's going on if it's explained to them appropriately, and they can respond appropriately that way. The treatment is often different for children. They may have different reactions to medications. Children at different ages may have different side effects. There are certain medications that shouldn't be given to very young children. The dosages certainly will be different, and young children may need to take a liquid form or have a pill ground up and mixed with applesauce or peanut butter in order for them to take it. So again, there are many differences in children's reactions and children's treatment, and there are a number of websites that are really good looking into this and helping kids prepare for emergencies.
Speaking of websites, what resources would you recommend for listeners who want to pursue some of these issues further?
FEMA has an excellent website for kids, www.fema.gov/kids, and there's ready.gov/kids. And many of the websites referred back to Ready Kids, where they have a number of different ways to teach children about emergencies, including some coloring books or some games to play. Many states have great websites. Virginia Department of Health and Virginia Emergency Management have really good websites. ReadyVirginia.gov is a website for preparedness. but a number of states have excellent websites. It's important to look for your specific state for both your health department website and your emergency management website to get information. Babyzone.com, articles to prepare children for emergencies. The Red Cross as well, redcross.org, and firesafety.gov/kids.
Well, we are fortunate that Dr. Lisa Kaplowitz could join us today to share her expertise and experience about what kids need in a national or regional medical emergency. So, Dr. Kaplowitz, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. Please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 401, and please tell us if you can what station you are tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from our listeners. Our sound engineer is Nate DeLuca. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.